Okay, thank you. We're about to enter the second part of our afternoon program, and we're going to move from looking at the current situation in the United States to the current situation in two other countries, Canada and Sweden. And our first speaker in this next portion of the program is Tom Isaacs. Tom currently directs the institutional planning activities of the Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory, and he is a routine publisher and lecturer on topics associated with nuclear power, national security, nuclear materials management, and repository development. Might also point out that Tom has had a long history with the Department of Energy and the Atomic Energy Commission, and is probably suffering through a pretty severe case of deja vu as he hears us talk in 2008 about things he remembers talking about in 1992. and then probably before that in the 70s. But in any case, Tom's going to be speaking to us today from the standpoint as an advisor to the Canadian Nuclear Waste Management Organization, and he'll be talking about the Canadian Repository Program, helping society make up its mind. Please welcome Tom Isaacs.
So, I don't understand why everyone is so honored to talk to Frank Parker today. My experiences with Frank started when I was in the DOE repository program, and Frank was the chair of the Board on Radioactive Waste Management, and I would say quarterly I would go into that meeting of the board, and I would be the pincushion, and Frank would be the chief pin, along with many others arrayed before you here. But I was reminded in this morning's conversation, I hadn't planned on saying this, but I was reminded of one of my favorite quotes by Jonathan Swift, who says that man is not a reasonable animal. He's an animal capable upon occasion of reason. And I think that when we talk about what's required for success in a program like this, I think it's important to understand who we all work for and what it is we're trying to achieve here. And I tried to reflect it in the title here. I mean, I'm going to have to bite my tongue a lot in this talk because I was in the U.S. repository program for a number of years. And in fact, I was in the smoke-filled room in December of 87 working with Bennett Johnston and several other senators and key congressmen around the table when the Amendment Act was hammered out. And if I have a moment, I might just reflect a little bit on what actually happened there. There's lore and then there's what actually happened, and they're almost the same, but not quite. So what I plan on doing is covering three topics, and I have good news and bad news. The bad news first is that, unfortunately, you're hearing from me and not Atsu Suzuki, who couldn't make it here. And so David asked me if I would expand my remarks to also talk a bit about the international situation. So my remarks will be a little bit longer than they might have otherwise been. The good news is I don't know much about a lot of the international situation, and so I'll make up what I don't know, and then we'll have people like Klaus fix it when I'm done. So I plan on doing three things in this talk. The first one is to give you a brief and selective review. Selective means I'm going to talk more about the stuff I have some semblance of knowledge about and less about the stuff I don't know about, of what's going on in the rest of the world with regard to repositories, because it's very important that we all understand, and there's a lot to be learned, and I'm sure you know that, from each other's successes and failures. Secondly, ironically, I'm here to talk about the Canadian repository program, even though I was in the U.S. repository program. And I have been involved for the last 4 or 5 years in helping them sort of pick up the pieces and reformulate their program. And the Canadians have done, in my view, a very good job of getting that program back on track. There's still a long way to go. But I'll tell you some of the things that they're doing, because I think it's instructive and it might actually provide some lessons. And then I will give some concluding thoughts, which will range from 50 feet to 100,000 feet on where we might learn and where we might want to go. So let's talk about the repository first for a moment. Some things that you already know. It's already been said. It's ironic, I think. It's now been more than 50 years, and geologic disposal remains the preferred solution for virtually every country who's serious about ultimately disposing of nuclear waste. And that's true whether there's going to be reprocessing or not. Most of the technical community who are associated with assessing the suitability of sites is quite confident that if there is a good site and they are asked to characterize it and given enough money and time, they will be able to determine the suitability of that site. And they, in many cases, in fact, most cases, believe that they can make a cogent licensing case. And so I think that's an interesting point. You'll note as you look around the world that many different kind of media are being considered. There's a general sense that geologic disposal does not have to be limited to one or two types of rock type, but that there are many types of indigenous materials, some of which, like salt, are not even rock in the same classical sense, where we can suitably dispose of this material. Siting almost everywhere, although there are a couple of exceptions, and we're going to hear from one of them from Klaus very shortly, remains the biggest hurdle. And that's true pretty much everywhere, and it's true for a variety of reasons. I'm going to talk largely about the institutional aspects of things, but one of the points I want to make is there is no separation in my mind in a good program between the technical and the institutional. Institutional stuff is not hiring some public relations expert to come in and try and convince the public that you know what you're doing. That won't work, and I'll return to that a bit later, but I do plan on talking more about the institutional aspects. A number of things have become prominent in the international family of repository programs over the last several years. Movement from sort of a big finger coming down from the sky saying, we've decided you're it, to this idea that we really need to move more toward a voluntary approach and possible veto, where if a municipality doesn't want it, they don't have to have it. Retrievability was not always something intrinsic in most repository programs. The U.S. law and regulations required 50 years of retrievability. Most countries have now come to see retrievability as more than a technical requirement, but as part of an institutional approach to showing people that we want to do what's right in order to build confidence and demonstrate performance. Monitoring, again, not always part of the program. The general belief was if we can get a license from the regulator, we have demonstrated to a sufficient degree that, in fact, this repository is going to be safe. Why would we want to spend money and time monitoring something after this facility is in operation? That has also changed. And lastly, and I'm going to talk more about this because the Canadians are among those who adopt this, this whole idea of phase management, that there are indeed ways of approaching managing the program, not just what you do, but how you do it, that are as important and maybe more important to the success of the program. We're going to have storage for decades. We've already heard that from lots of folks. And even if repository programs open, and even if they open on time, the time it will take to dispose of that waste into a repository will be decades, and it will be decades before these facilities are open in almost all cases. And so I think one should recognize that we do have to store for quite some period of time most of the spent fuel and or high-level waste. And lastly, one of the reasons we're here, hope springs eternal in all kinds of ways. There are still beliefs that some people have, that Yucca Mountain can be sited and opened, that indeed public attitudes, if we just talk well, may be changing, that people are more accepting of the idea of nuclear power and therefore might return to the idea of what it takes to be successful with nuclear repositories. There are always the magic machines like partitioning and transmutation where you put waste in, electricity comes out, gold ingots come out the back, and so we have programs along those lines. Next slide, please. So where are we around the world? Well, there's good news, and then there's bad news, and then there's probably some worse news. And that's that a lot of programs in a lot of countries, countries that we feel are at the cutting edge of understanding and technology, have had real serious problems. This is just a list of, at the first bullet, of countries where programs have actually either been abandoned or the siting stopped. And you can see that countries like France, where you tend to think of, a leading nuclear power, have been very successful with their nuclear power program, were stopped dead in their tracks for a period of time. The UK has been wandering in the wilderness just now, finally trying to get themselves back on track. Canada, where I was asked to participate, had a very robust program, stopped dead in its tracks, and on, including the US, where, as we heard earlier, there were some early activities at Lyons, Kansas, the first repository program where we were supposed to characterize by law three sites was truncated to one site. The second repository program, which was there as an equity issue, and I'm going to return to that in a minute as well. It's important to try and understand why these things were passed and what promises were made, and when we unmake promises, what does it say about the longer-term trust and confidence? Because that's going to be the thread of my talk as well as it has been of many other people. As a result of these problems, several countries have had reviews or re-reviews of where their programs have gone. Just in the most recent past, in the last two or three years, Canada, France, and UK have all reassessed their repository programs and started over, in a sense, and in many cases learned lessons from the problems that they had in the first attempts and have been moving forward with much more success. And I think there's a lot of optimism for that. Schedules have been delayed almost everywhere, with the possible exception of Finland, and to some extent I think even Sweden has probably had some delays, although you can hear from Klaus directly. But countries are moving forward. It's a mixed bag. Finland and Sweden are the world leaders. I think that's generally acknowledged in terms of how they run their programs and indeed how much progress they are making. The U.S. obviously has a site and is moving forward as well. All right, so what are some of the key issues around the world? Well, first of all, many folks believe that there's a linkage between disposal and the idea of a nuclear renaissance. This whole issue of, can you indeed move to return to building new nuclear power plants, or even in some cases extending the license of existing plants, if you don't have a solution to the waste disposal problem, or if you don't have at least a vigorous nuclear waste disposal program? That continues to be an issue. It is certainly an issue in Canada, I can tell you. The questions about impacts of direct disposal versus reprocessing, which I often find as, you know, it's kind of like, you know, tastes great, less filling. It's an argument that, to me, doesn't have very much validity behind it. We need to move forward with a solution. It needs to be appropriate for whether or not there's reprocessing, in my mind. And if indeed there's reprocessing, if indeed there's advanced partitioning and transmutation or some other mechanism like that, we can certainly take advantage of it. That doesn't relieve us, I believe, of the responsibility to move forward. There's lots of attention and controversy over the ideas of multinational or international repository programs. This is an issue whose time, I believe, is coming, much to the discomfort of a lot of folks. There are approximately 30 countries in the world today that have nuclear power. 15 of them have 5 or fewer nuclear power plants. If you look to the coming generation, there are about 30 new power plants under construction, but there are some 200 to 300 that are either planned or being considered in 40 additional countries. If some subset of that happens, there's going to have to be a consideration about now what the responsible thing to do is with regard to the management and ultimate disposition of that fuel. How we go about thinking about that problem is going to be the last thing I talk about. And lastly, the last thing I'm going to talk about is this, that I believe that there is a direct and important relationship between the nuclear waste management activities that we're talking about here, the spread of nuclear power, and national security. We have heard almost nothing about national security today, so I will spend some part of my time describing why I believe those things are inextricably linked. So now, that's all I have to say about the Canadian program, the international program. So can we move on to the Canadian program? There we go. So just so you know, Canada had a very vigorous and I think in many senses successful repository program for a long time. When I was in the department, among my responsibilities was managing our international program. And for a number of years, we spent, the U.S. repository program spent millions of dollars a year doing research and development in Canada's underground research lab. We were precluded from being on the site at Yucca Mountain at that point in time, and it provided us with a wonderful opportunity to develop and learn how to use instruments, how to take data, how to analyze data, how to deal with the problems of being underground, and how to collaborate with a very fine group of technical experts. That program was essentially stopped in the late 1990s, and it was stopped because of a commission that was headed by a man named Blair Seaborn. And so they had what was called the Seaborn panel that put out the Seaborn report. And here you see the most important conclusions. There was no technical expert on the Seaborn panel. There was no technical expertise. This was made up of a group of broadly perspectived, widely educated people who looked at this program from Canada's broadest point of view. And they came to the conclusion that while the program indeed, from a technical point of view, looked good, from a social perspective, they hadn't done the work that was necessary to prepare Canadian society to be accepting of this at all. And so they believed that there was no acceptability in a social sense, what they called social safety as opposed to technical safety, and that therefore this program was not going to be successful. The program was stopped. The work was stopped. The people were no longer in in business, and they went into a hiatus. In 2002, after several years of discussion, the Canadian Parliament passed a new law, the Nuclear Fuel Waste Act of 2002. And it came into law, as you can see, on November 15th of that year. And it had several stipulations that said that, first of all, that a new organization called the Nuclear Waste Management Organization was to be created by the major waste owners. And there are four utilities, that plus AECL, that have nuclear power operations in Canada. And that they were to establish a new organization on their own, not part of the government, beholden to the government for policy and guidance, but not part of the government. And that they were to create an advisory committee. They were to recommend proposed approaches for Canada's management of its spent nuclear fuel. And I might mention that because Canada has CANDU reactors, which use natural uranium, the volume of spent fuel that Canada produces is about the same as the U.S., even though they have one-fifth the number of nuclear reactors. It's a large quantity of spent nuclear fuel. They had 3 years in order to complete their study from a standing start. There was no organization on November 15, 2002. They had 3 years to complete this study and very significant economic penalties for every day that they were late. They were to submit their report to the government, to the minister, and they were to put in place a funding system, a financing system, much like the Nuclear Waste Fund, although it is segregated and part of the Nuclear Waste Management Organization, and again, not part of the problems that we have heard very well spoken by Ward Sproat, where it is now a zero-sum game within the U.S. Department of Energy, and therefore it becomes very difficult to have the adequate amount of funds and even predictable amount of funds. So the mandate, if I could have the next one, of what they were supposed to do was to look at least three specific technical approaches to the program. And they could look at others, and they did look at others, but these three were required. Deep geologic disposal in the Canadian Shield, which was the AECL concept of old that had been stopped, storage at the nuclear reactor sites, and centralized storage either above or below ground. These sound pretty familiar, don't they, to the kinds of things that we've been hearing wrestled with over the last 30 years or so here in the United States. The study was required in each case to include not only a technical description, but an explicit comparison of the benefits, costs, and risks, and importantly, the ethical, social, economic, and Aboriginal considerations. The Aboriginal community in Canada has a very important standing in their operations and implementation of programs that tend to affect the lands on which they have rights. And in this case, I can tell you, they have taken the Aboriginal inclusion into this program extremely seriously. They also created an ethics panel, for example, a number of other things, which I'll talk about on the next slide. It was required that they look at specific economic regions. That doesn't mean sites, but it means regions of Canada, and that they have an implementation plan for each of these. Next, please. Some of the keys to the Canadian approach, and this is kind of where yours truly became part of their team, if you will, but was led by a president of NWMO who was not a technical person, had no technical training. Her name is Liz Dowdswell. She had a number of positions in Canada. She was also the head of the UN Environmental Organization for 5 years, and she, I call her the Oprah of Canada. I mean, she really understood not just the technical program, but all the dimensions that are required in order to build trust and confidence, in my view. So the first point is that process was considered as important as the decision itself. How one reached the decision was something that was discussed and debated and thought through over and over again with regard to how we demonstrate inclusion, how we demonstrate fairness, how we demonstrate transparency, all of those kinds of things. It required an enormous amount of work, and keep in mind the clock was ticking here, of widespread dialogues. There were citizen panels convened all over Canada more than once. There were meetings after meetings with various affected parties. There were opportunities to interact on the web. Many of the most modern technologies were used. There were podcasts that were used to both inform but also involve anyone and everyone who felt like they had a role to play. I already mentioned the ethics roundtable and transparency. Next, please. This is out of the report. This is just an example of the things that were done for broad engagement. And I think the main point here is there is a tendency an over-tendency, in my view, to talk about public communication in terms of what it takes in order to get public acceptance. And I think public communication or public relations or giving information is necessary, but it is far from sufficient. You really have got to invest yourself in a dialogue and an involvement in a variety of ways if you're going to build the kind of relationships that are required. So I already mentioned the Roundtable on Ethics. That was a group of, I think, about 8 or 9 ethicists who met regularly, who were briefed on the program, who debated the program, who fed information back into the program, who were then responded to in real time. It was a very serious ongoing effort. It wasn't always easy. These guys don't speak our language, but it was very important. There were community dialogues with all the communities that have nuclear power plants now to try and get their understanding of the perspectives they have with regard to solving this problem, because obviously they were heavily involved. One of the solutions was to leave it at the reactor sites. There were public information meetings. There were these national citizen dialogues where huge amounts of effort went into attracting broad cross-sections that were looked at carefully to ensure they were broad cross-sections, to spending whole weekends in both informing people of what the plant program was all about, because, of course, nobody understood it, and then asking them for their opinions. I was part of what was called the assessment team. I was one of 2 non-Canadians that was part of, I think, 9 or 10 people that were put together, very few technical people. There were 2 or 3 technical people. There were people from a whole variety. The chairman was a cybernetician and a former junior partner of Buckminster Fuller, to give you an idea of the kinds of people that they went out there and got to try and assess overall what makes sense for a program like this. They did scenarios. They didn't just say, this is the way the future is going to unfold. They said, we don't know how the future is going to unfold. We talked earlier about the planning for an uncertain future. They actually did many scenario exercises to say, what would happen if we had a return to nuclear power? What would happen if nuclear power went away? What would happen if other things occurred? That was all done. Next. They went through 3 documents before they put out a final report. The first document was titled, Are We Asking the Right Questions? It was not a document about this is what we think we ought to do. It was a question about what are the things that are important for NWMO to consider in going forward in putting together a recommendation. That was then put out there, public comment. The National Citizen Dialogues were engaged once again, and then they put out a second document. Then they put out a third, which was a draft proposal that was distributed throughout Canada for comment, and only then did they come out with their final recommendation in a report called Choosing a Way Forward. And if you go to the nwmo.ca website, you can see all of this material. This, to my mind, was the foundation of where the Canadian program came out as a result of all this work. And I think this is very important to consider. It's not the only formulation, but I think it's a very good example. And it says, this generation of citizens which has enjoyed the benefits of nuclear power has an obligation to begin provision for managing that waste. It's not okay to simply store this material and leave it to future generations to solve. There's an obligation, an ethical obligation, that this generation, it may not solve the problem by itself, but it has a responsibility to take an active and vigorous program forward that is directed toward ultimately solving this problem. And secondly, our obligation is to give the succeeding generations a real choice and an opportunity to shape their own decisions while at the same time not imposing a burden which they may not be able to bear. In other words, move toward a permanent solution, but as an explicit objective, preserve the flexibility for future generations to do what's in their own best interest and to be able to either implement the program as it's moving forward or adapt it or change it to meet their perceptions. By the way, as a little secret, that's all you can do anyway. All this talk about what we're going to do in the next 10 and 20 and 30 and 50 years is silly. The people who are in charge then are going to be making those decisions. You can preclude options if you're silly and you're short-sighted, but you can't mandate what somebody in 2098 is going to do. I mean, it's just imagine if we sat here today and said, you know, those guys in 1958 were very smart, and so we're going to do what they suggested. We're going to use all the materials that were cutting state-of-the-art at that point in time. We're going to do all the implementation just the way of course you're not going to do that. There will be progress. There'll be learning. There'll be unanticipated changes. You have to prepare for those things because they're going to happen whether you want them to or not. Next, please. I just put this up here. This is interesting to me. On the top is the actual set of criteria that were used to judge the sites for the first repository in the United States. That was the criteria that were used that got us to the three recommended sites, by the way, of which Yucca Mountain was the best-looking site. Now, they were all very close, with the exception of Hanford, and if I had more time, I would tell you some more about that. But basically, those are the criteria. 20 years later, the Canadians did a multi-attribute utility analysis very similar to that. And I point this out, and I highlighted three in red because the rest of it's fairly similar. Keep in mind, there are two different decisions being made. The top decision is it's a beauty contest among sites. Which sites are we going to characterize? We put five sites in, three sites were recommended. The bottom one is which of three approaches or additional approaches should Canada take for managing its spent fuel? The difference in the Canadian approach, I think, tells stories in each of those cases. The first one is fairness. They made an explicit provision that while it's very difficult to know what's fairer than something else, to the extent that one can identify that a certain approach tends to be fairer to the affected populations than another approach, it is one factor that would play in the advantage of that particular approach. Fairness counted in all of its ways, and we looked at that in a variety of ways, from the temporal point of view of how things look now to the burden on future generations. Security. There was nothing in 1986 about security. What that tells me, of course, that was a pre-9/11 world. What that tells me is that the world changes. I think it should tell all of us. It's a good object lesson that we were making decisions at a time when that wasn't a consideration. And now you can't. It's hard to imagine that we would make a consideration about what to do about spent fuel that didn't include security. There may be things 20 years from now that society decides are very important that we have no notion of today. You know, this hubris argument is exactly right. I mean, we have to be humble about our ability to understand what's likely to unfold here. And that leads me to adaptability. Adaptability was considered, after a lot of discussion, to be an explicit objective. Adaptable in two ways. How well would the repository, if implemented, be able to handle unforeseen incidents? And you talk about climate change, for example, or ice ages. I mean, Canada's really in the path of the next ice age. So the idea of both the intrinsic ability of the repository to handle unanticipated events, the approach to handle unanticipated events, and the ability of the approach to handle changes in knowledge and values over the lifetime of the system, all were included in the evaluation. Next, please. All right? So here were some of the key recommendations that were made. The first one was that the management approach would be what they called adaptive phase management. And if you've been listening to much of the discussion here today or reading documents that have been produced by the National Academy and others over the last 25 or take your pick, 50 years, this sequential decision-making, this flexibility in the pace and manner of implementation became the foundation of how they were going to go forward. In terms of objectives, they said ultimately there should be centralized isolation in a deep geologic repository. If you looked at those objectives I mentioned earlier, that was a fairly clear statement. But there was also an option for interim underground storage at the site. This, to me, makes imminent sense and has made sense, by the way, for the United States for as long as I can recall. This argument of repository versus storage, we made recommendations decades ago that we should have both. And the most sensible place, it's not the only place, the most sensible place would be at Yucca Mountain. Only after there was a license for Yucca Mountain to accept all the waste so that you were not cutting corners. But once you had that license, it seems obvious that you want at least the option of bringing that waste away from the nuclear utilities. And I totally agree with the comment earlier that they are not in the business of long-term spent fuel storage, and that the more appropriate thing to do is for the organization in charge to take responsibility for that material. Explicitly in the program is the idea that they are going to continue learning, and therefore that a vigorous R&D program in both technical and social issues will be maintained. And they have done that. They have a very robust program to try and understand better the technical issues and the social issues that can help make that program run better. I've already talked about the monitoring. And lastly, as so many countries have done, they said they're going to seek an informed, willing community to be the host. Note that that doesn't say volunteer. There may be a distinction there, although I'm sure they would love to have some volunteers to choose among. That doesn't necessarily mean a volunteer. It means a discussion and engagement that may lead at some point in time for a community that looks very promising to say, yes, we understand this, and we are willing to accept it. Next, please. So the program is designed to be quite adaptive during the active period, what we would call pre-closure in the United States. The idea that they're going to learn new things, that the program should reflect that new knowledge, and that it will not be static, that indeed there will be social learning, changes in values, technical advantages, and Aboriginal traditional knowledge, which will all play into this. They also recognize, as they move forward in this period, that Canada's consideration of new nuclear power plant build will probably be resolved, and they will have a better understanding of just how much spent fuel they might be dealing with. And indeed, some of the contingency planning that was done was to understand what the implications would be for this program if indeed there was a robust new nuclear build, although they are agnostic on whether or not Canada should build new nuclear power plants. There may be reduced uncertainties and changes on reprocessing. Canada has no plans, not even an inkling in its eye at this moment, to reprocess or to take advantage of advanced technologies like partitioning and transmutation, but they do have what they call a watching brief and have looked at what the implications would be if sometime in the future this became important for Canada and what its impacts might be. And lastly, and I think this is an important point, I don't think the responsibility of the implementer is just to get a license. I think the responsibility of the implementer is to convince itself that it has done as well as it can do and has confidence itself that it is going to provide a safe and environmentally acceptable solution, and then convince the regulator that it has also met the regulations. And I think that's seen here because they don't believe that you should stop R&D to reduce repository performance even after the license. Next, please. So I'm going to go quickly over this one because I think we've already talked about it. They really do want to preserve real options for the program. So there are decision points along the way over the next decades at which they will reflect on what they have learned and either reassert the program as it is going forward or make modifications based on new learning. They also have contingency plans in the sense that so many people here have mentioned we ought to have contingency plans in the event that things don't go the way one anticipated. They're going to provide opportunities for engagement for future generations. Operation of this facility may well have a responsibility of local communities in determining just how quickly that waste gets disposed of. If they choose, for example, to build a storage facility at the site, and that's the only place they would build it, by the way, is at the site, once that waste starts to go there, you then have the flexibility of deciding how quickly to put it underground. There doesn't become the same rush to put it underground. And lastly, they're focusing on initially on the provinces in which there is already nuclear activity. This was a fairness issue. Doesn't mean that other provinces are precluded from volunteering or that they won't somehow come into the fray, but right now they are going to start by looking at those provinces where nuclear power plays a big role. Next, please. So what's the current status of the Canadian program? The government did accept the NWMO recommendations in that report, including the adaptive phase management. NWMO is right now in the middle of a two-year phase to develop a siting process. I think this is an interesting thing. Instead of saying, we got the recommendation, now we're going to begin siting, they dedicated themselves in this recommendation report to the fact that if it's approved, they would spend 2 years engaging society in helping get assistance in how they should approach siting. So they are right now about to engage Canadian society once again with the idea of asking the question, help us decide how we should approach siting in the fairest way possible. They're moving from an implementation, that engagement will start this year. They're moving from an implementation, from a recommending organization to an implementing organization. That has, for you, that may not mean much. For them, that means they're growing by a factor of four. And that they're, so it's going from a little boutique organization to a much larger operating organization with a lot more technical and institutional expertise. They have a board of directors that up until now has been made up of the key senior officials from the utilities. That's now being broadened to include people who have other interests and perspectives, but there are questions about balance of this board that still remain in people's minds. You know, Canada has a lot of the same kind of people. They have their own Tom Cotton, and Tom Cochran. I mean, those kind of people exist in all countries. Yeah. Yeah, they do. They do. Yeah. Yeah, there's only one time. But in all those cases, there are legitimate questions in Canada about the extent to which alternative points of view are going to be fed into the board management there. I've already talked about the technical programs and the new build. Siting remains the key step in Canada. They have done, I believe, a very fine job of trying to put together an approach that is both technically sophisticated and institutionally sophisticated. They still have to go out there and find a site, and that will be a major challenge. So that's the Canadian program. So now my last points. So let me just talk a bit about what we might learn from this. So what makes nuclear waste management special? We've heard a lot of these things already today. In my view, there's some technical issues and there's some institutional issues. Certainly the technical issues should not be shortchanged. Understanding and demonstrating suitability of a site over hundreds of thousands of years or a million years is a daunting task, and as we've heard very well stated already, proof in the classical sense of it is just not possible. It's also true that this program has a central role for ologists, hydrologists, geologists, climatologists, volcanologists, seismologists, sociologists, psychologists. I mean, it's all required in order to understand. And then there's the institutional challenges that have to do, again, with people trying to wrap their head around just what an extraordinary time frame this is. The fact that we are talking about shifting the burden of this material from a variety of places to one place. You know, that whole siting issue is unlike most others, maybe any others. Linkage to other agendas. There are a lot of people who would understand and would like to see a repository, but not until nuclear power was killed, as an example. The linkage between a successful repository program and other people's agendas does flavor the way people think about this. Somebody already mentioned, I think it might have been Dick, I'm not sure, this idea of value, or it might have been John, values and ethics are in conflict. You know, legitimate people who have the right attitude in mind might differ on their views on what's important here and how to prescribe an ethical approach to things. There are political implications. Elections are won and lost on this issue. There are two U.S. senators in the United States who lost their positions because it was perceived they were not enough against the repository program in this country. That was Slade Gordon in Washington State when we were looking at Washington as one of the sites, and Chick Hecht in the state of Nevada, both of whom were against the program and were voted out in very close elections where many people thought that the swing issue was that they couldn't stop the program. Chick Hecht, by the way, went on to become ambassador to Bermuda, and I always... I think he won, and I always loved the line... I always loved the line that when he was given this designation, he said, "This is the perfect job for me because I love to play golf." And of course, there are these unique issues associated with the nuclear stigma and fears. These are reasonable concerns. You know, the fact that as a scientist, you may say, "Well, geez, you shouldn't feel that way," doesn't relieve you of the obligation to understand that that's the way they feel, and they are society, and these are things that we have to deal with. But all of it, I believe, comes down to trust and confidence and a lack thereof. And we heard some of it reflected over and over here. I mean, Dick was talking about the licensing process as if there isn't trust. I don't think there is trust in the licensing process in this country. I don't think we trust ourselves to do the right thing. That's not the way it is in some other countries. There is much more of a sense of responsibility that the regulator is operating on behalf of the public interest, that the implementer lives in the community in which the activity is going on, that their family lives there, that their children live there, that they would not do something untoward in that regard. I don't think we have that kind of trust in this country. The Monitored Retrievable Storage Commission, on which Frank Parker served, dealt with this issue of whether we should have storage or not, and it was a major problem because people felt that if you had a storage facility, it would become a de facto repository. In other words, we would not do the right thing. Once we had a surface storage facility, we wouldn't have the political will and spend the economic and political capital in order to build the repository, even though that was the right thing to do. However, even though there's all these issues that make it tough, there are some unique advantages as well. And I think somehow that is often overlooked and can be among the keys to framing a program that has better chances of success. A repository, when it's finished, is passive. There are no moving parts. It just sits there and cooks. Anything that occurs... It's good, George, that's good. Anything that occurs will be quite slow, and it's not like turning on a nuclear power plant or a reprocessing plant where if something unexpected happens, you now have a mess on your hand. A repository, if it's designed properly and developed properly, should be reversible. It should be, the material should be retrievable. And so you have the opportunity to not have to make all the decisions up front, even though the regulation requires you to make a demonstration of performance up front. You have a chance to build your program in a way that earns trust by performance. It's only a repository when it's closed. You don't get to make that decision. I don't get to make that decision. It'll probably be generations far in the future, if there's a repository opening, who will finally have the trust and the confidence to say, this is what we want to do with that facility. And no amount of arm-waving by this generation will change that option for them. So we might as well take advantage of it. Next, please. So, day after Thanksgiving, my wife, son, and I went down to Santa Barbara for a couple days, R&R, and as we were walking along the beach, my wife told me, she said, you know, we were here once for a week along the beach. And it reminded me of the week that the Academy, under the leadership of Frank, held a meeting in Santa Barbara that led to rethinking high-level waste. That meeting was in 1988. It took them 2 years, really short time for the Academy, to get that report out. And there are several people in the audience who were part of that activity, which underpins my view that a career in waste management is lifetime employment. But what they did was really clever, and very much like what's going on here today. They brought in not only members of the Board on Radioactive Waste Management, they invited in people from the government, like myself, who was very pleased and happy to have an opportunity to participate. They brought in people from other countries who had their own perspectives. They brought in people who had expertise in other dimensions that had nothing to do with radioactive waste management to lend their expertise. And it was one of the most invigorating, exciting weeks I can remember in this kind of a discussion. And out of it came the Rethinking Report. In my view, it is still the seminal report, almost 20 years later. And if you want to start thinking about how to cobble together programs that work, I suggest going back and taking a look at this report. And here are some of the things you heard from others. So John mentioned some of the things that are in here. These were some of the things that were mentioned in there, that the idea of the U.S. program was that it was too inflexible and prescriptive at the time. One could say, in some senses, it still is. It suffers. It's not the fault, by the way, of DOE. I was in the belly of that beast for a long time. And if one is inside that program, you recognize quickly that there's only so many things one can do. When I joined the program in 1984, a year after the act was passed, it took me 2 weeks to recognize that there was no way that we were going to make 1998. But that was the law. And we had to do everything possible to make 1998, even though there was no way to make it. And it required us to do things that didn't make a lot of sense. Nonetheless, this idea that we have to get things right the first time and that things have to be closed quickly so we can get to licensing, as an example now, just were not conducive to the kind of problem we were trying to solve here. And that fact that safety is in part a social judgment. The question of how safe is safe enough is not a decision only for technical people. It is a discussion among society to come to a resolution in an open and transparent way that you may or might not like the answer to. It also recommended a flexible and incremental approach. It said, define the goal broadly. Figure out what your vision is, what it is you're trying to achieve, but recognize that you're going to learn as you go, and you're going to improve as you learn. And build that into your program. There's nothing to be ashamed of there. It's something you ought to go for. And lastly, it talked about moral and ethical issues. And I've already talked about some of these, so I won't refer to them again. But just the issue of a fair process, and I'm going to talk about, just for 1 second, the 70,000 metric ton limit. Let me tell you something. There is no 70,000 metric ton limit. There never has been. Yucca Mountain by law can hold 5,000 metric tons or 200,000 metric tons, and it doesn't require a change in the law. All it says is that you can't put more than 70,000 metric tons in until a second repository is open. Why did it say that? Why did the law say 70,000 metric tons as a guide? Because at the time the law was passed, the best estimate of how much this generation of nuclear power plants was going to generate was 140,000 metric tons. And there was an equity issue, because most people thought the first repository would likely be somewhere in the west, and people know that 80% of the nuclear power was generated east of the Mississippi River. So they put in there a check and balance that said, if you're going to put the first repository in the west, you're not going to put all that waste in there until there's a second repository. Now, we hear lots of discussion about GNEP and reprocessing and changing the limits on the level of Yucca Mountain. I think any discussion that starts to look at that issue should start from the point of view of why there was a second repository program in the first place and why it's acceptable. I'm not saying it's not, but why it's acceptable to change that compromise that allowed the law to pass in the first place. The same thing can be said, by the way, about the first repository and the narrowing of three sites to one and the premature stopping of the second repository by the secretary. And I was in the department when it happened. I understand. I have the lash marks on my back for this. Nonetheless, I think when it comes to the fact of a repository program, we're going to be in the business for generations, even if this program stays on schedule. Somebody was saying last night, isn't it too bad that Harry Reid is in the position he is in? You are guaranteed over the life of this program to have basically every kind of political formulation you can imagine. You are going to have to deal with every kind of formulation. You better run the program right. You better start from a point of ethical responsibility and doing what's right, not from the point of view of expediency. Part of the difficulty Yucca Mountain has had, and again, I don't fault only the program, is in the 25 years since the nuclear, and it's 25 years this month, since the Nuclear Policy Waste Act was passed, I don't think there was ever a time when it didn't appear to the program like the next 6 months were critical to survival. For 25 years, it has operated in a survival mode as if it has been tied to the rail tracks and the train is coming around the bend. It has made over and over again short-term, suboptimal, survival kinds of decisions. It's really hard to build trust and confidence and a sense of stability as the directors go in and out a revolving door with a program in this kind of a mode. So I was delighted to hear Warsprout talk about this readdressing of the possibility of some other ways of managing the program. The last thing I'll say about the rethinking report is it made a very clear point that not acting also has consequences. This is not about whether we want nuclear waste or not. That problem was decided quite some time ago. The question is, what's the right thing to do? We're going to have the waste, and it's basically down to storage or disposal. Next, please. So let me put up for you a definition of program success. I won't be here tomorrow, so I'll let you guys wrestle over this. And I just want to stop for 1 second to say why I won't be here, because I had a previous engagement that I have to go chair a session tomorrow afternoon in California with a group of professors from the University of Tokyo who are coming to the University of California, Berkeley. The Japanese government just gave $21 million to the University of Tokyo to revitalize their nuclear education program and to train not just people in nuclear physics and radiation physics and nuclear engineering, but as an explicit objective, what they call nuclear sociology. Now, that's a term I kind of like. I don't know what it means yet. I don't think they know what it means yet. But it means, what does it take beyond the classical education to be successful, both within Japan and as international leaders in framing the next generation of the nuclear regime? I think that's very exciting. And I just wanted to point that out, because I think this education point that Catherine made is an extremely important one. So back to the talk. So what's a definition of success? Is there another definition other than getting a license and stuffing the waste in the ground? I think those virtues of the repository that I mentioned open up a new way of thinking about success. And this is an example. It's not the only example, but it looks at a more sequential, iterative way of making a commitment. And so I'll just point out a couple of these things. It says you go for a repository site. It has to be licensed for the full amount of waste. I don't think you can license this thing piecemeal. I don't think it's a legitimate thing to do. You need to build sufficient societal consent to start this program. You need to put some waste in the ground. This is along the proposal made. It's different, but along the proposal that Tom Cochran mentioned. I think you need maybe even to take some out to demonstrate you know how to retrieve the waste. You need to have measures in place that allow then sequential decision making in just how much and how fast the rest of the waste goes in the ground. You put in place the procedures and the requirements that allow you to either finish disposing of this waste, or if future generations decide to do something different, for them to have that flexibility. And you analyze all the other things, particularly interim storage, that will be required in order for you to move forward in this regard. That's a very different way of thinking about success. It doesn't require 70,000 metric tons in the ground to be successful. It doesn't require only an interim storage facility. In some sense, it requires both, but it is a very different way of thinking about it, in my view. So on to the last couple slides. So what I think of as key enduring features. Not enough is made about the program need for this program. We do not do a very good job of why this program is necessary. And I've heard several people here today sort of indicate they don't think it is. I disagree, but I think it's very necessary. But whatever the program is, people are unlikely to support it if they don't believe it's needed. You need a core stable goal. I believe the core stable goal is ultimate disposal in a suitable deep geologic repository. But whatever it is, it needs to be out there. At the same time, roles and responsibilities need to be clear. People need to understand who they go to get answers and who's responsible for various actions that are taken. Transparency is talked about so much that I won't mention it. Respect for fairness and societal consent has to be apparent. To the extent that any program looks like it is imposing its will on some community, I think you're going to have a great deal of trouble being successful. I've already talked about sequential decision-making and the need for contingency planning because stuff happens, you know? And you need to be prepared that you might have to, over the 100 years of a repository program, change. And lastly, there hasn't been much discussion of it, but you need compensation. You need to do it in a creative way. The way to get compensation is not to give money. It's to learn from the community what works for them as part of the bargain that they are going to have to live with. In many cases, we have examples around the world in repository programs of very surprising answers to this. Okay, so my potential lessons learned. Take the necessary time. Go slow in order to go fast. Several people have said this. John Ahern said this in a different way. You know, the famous basketball coach, John Wooden, I don't know if I can say it exactly, but he says something like, be quick but don't hurry, to his basketball players. And that's what I'm talking about here. You need to move forward aggressively, but you cannot cut corners. You cannot hurry. The theme of part of this talk is the fact that the societal considerations count. They count a lot, and they're not afterthoughts. They are part of the way of designing and managing the program. Having senior officials, for example, spend the time in the communities. This happens, by the way, in places like Sweden and Finland. The senior people implementing the program and the regulators spend time in the communities. Those communities get to know those people. They get to see them as real people. It makes a very big difference. That societal building of trust and confidence is very important. We tend to think that there are a limited number of ways to engage stakeholders. We call a meeting, bring them in and say, sit down and we'll tell you what we're doing and then any questions. It's not a very effective way of engaging the public. I already showed you briefly in Canada a number of ways in which the public can be gained. This next point I consider to be one of the most important of all, and that's that it's not just talking to people. It really is not just listening to people. It's responding to people. If I had more time, I would tell you about some examples of where programs have actually been changed as a result of societal concerns in repository programs as well as other programs. I'll just tell you one quickly. When the Eurotunnel was being built, all right, I use this with students all the time, between France and England, there was a great concern. I went over there because we were going to look at their tunnel boring machines, because we were going to use the same thing at Yucca Mountain. There was a great concern in England about this Eurotunnel. And I read about it in one of the public offices that they had for the public at the center. And it had something completely I hadn't expected. And I usually ask students to guess what it is, but I won't take the time. What it is, the people in England were very concerned about dogs running through the tunnel and bringing rabies to England from France, the dirty dogs in France, the clean dogs in England, right? Instead of saying, you fools, you know, what are you thinking here? There are trains going through here. They have an explicit program to demonstrate that dogs can't get through, or any other animals for that matter, can't get through the tunnel. All right? They designed in features so dogs can't go. You don't tell people, I'm smarter than you, don't worry about this. You do something about it. That's a small, I could give you half a dozen examples, but that's one of my favorites. All right? We already heard, plan carefully and involve the right experts. You need to have people who appreciate the full dimensions of these issues. Somebody who doesn't know how to interact with people either needs to be trained or put in a job where they're not interacting with people, as an example. You really need to understand how exciting and multidimensional a program like this is and get the right kinds of expertise in there. You know, I was in a meeting about 3 weeks ago, no, 6 weeks ago at Stanford, that was about the future of nuclear power and its impact on security, which is my last slide. And I sat for 3 days next to a guy named Pief Panofsky. And Pief Panofsky was 88 years old. He died 2 days later. Pief Panofsky was 88 years old at the time, and I sat right next to him. And at the end of this meeting, and he was marvelous. He was the founding director of SLAC, the Stanford Linear Accelerator, and many other things, and a wonderful human being. And at the end of this 3 days with people, not as distinguished as you, but almost, and sitting around the table, all right, talking about issues of nuclear power and nuclear security, Pief got to make the last comments, and he talked about what he called the black swans, those totally rare, unpredictable events that change the course of history, and how no matter how much you prepare for the future, you need to be prepared for stuff happening that you won't anticipate. And the example he gave was, at that time, as I recall, was a sudden regime change in Pakistan. Ha ha. Okay? So as I simply put that up there as an example of this idea that stuff will happen, and there will be issues, and they will be unanticipated, and they will happen in real time. And even though you may want to take time, you need to have thoughts in your mind about how you're going to prepare to respond to those things. And then lastly, this issue of trust and confidence. You know, the way you build trust and confidence, I think there's a fairly simple formula. Again, I would encourage you all to think about somebody you have trust and confidence in. Don't pick your mother or your brother, but pick somebody. And why do you have trust and confidence in them? And I think I'll give you the short answer. I think there's other reasons, but basically three reasons. You believe that the person is competent and has a track record of competence in doing what they're supposed to do. You're not going to get on the airplane if you don't think the pilot's trained and has flown that plane before, and you don't want the doctor who's doing his first operation on you. So the first thing is you believe they're competent, they have a track record of competence. The second one is you believe they're going to make decisions that are in your best interests. No matter how competent they are, if you think they're not going to make decisions with your best interests at heart, you're not likely to trust them or have confidence in them. And the third one is largely this here. It's being willing to engage people in a very meaningful way and to actually listen to them and actually respond to. And I believe that if you think about who you trust and confidence, those tend to rise to the surface. Next, please. So what are I'm basically done. The last emerging issues, I think there are several connected emerging issues here that provide both a challenge and an opportunity for the waste management. The first is this growing understanding that there is a tie among nuclear power and the future of nuclear power, waste management, and non-proliferation. If we see a spread of nuclear power around the world, as we talked about and I briefly mentioned here, eventually, not in 5 years or in 10 years, but in 20 or 30 or 50 years, countries, because of their own energy security, are going to want to have their own ways of either enriching and or reprocessing spent fuel in order to assure fuel supplies. Because everybody understands that they're going to be going after the same fuel supplies in the coming generations with countries like China and India emerging such that it won't be just a matter of cost. That concern about the spread of enrichment and reprocessing has caused lots of folks to be concerned about a formulation for the next generation of how we're going to deal with that. And basically the one linchpin that might help in preserving a regime in which there is not a spread of enrichment and reprocessing in a way that would really aggravate nuclear proliferation is the consideration of spent fuel take back or take away. That is provisions of reactors and fresh fuel with a guarantee that that spent fuel will not have to be in a repository in a country that has one or two power plants, but will be returned to another country. That moves the repository from being simply a garbage dump to being an instrument of national security significance and part of the fabric of the nuclear regime. I don't have time to talk about it here, but I think it's very, very important and that it's part of the future. It won't be easy, it won't be quick, but it's certainly necessary, and I'll quit there.